title of my talk. It's a small group, so please feel free to interrupt, including the title slide. I'd like to give what I hope is sort of an unusual talk on microfluidics, and what I'd like to do is concentrate on three problems that we happen to be working on in microfluidics, and first tell you a little about the things we understand about these problems, and then tell you open questions, so things we don't understand about these problems. I try to summarize all three of these problems by maybe attributing this complexity to the fact that we're working at extreme scales, length scales, temporal scales, and concentration ratios. So concentrations are very important in microfluidics. So here's an outline of the talk. Again, I'll concentrate on three examples. One is a time scale where there's a temporal fluctuation, which becomes interesting. One where there's a concentration scale that is so high, a concentration ratio is so high, that makes modeling very, very difficult for us. And the third one is the length scale. So in case you don't know our group, we're in Stanford. My background's in mechanical engineering. My background's originally in fluid mechanics, and I've gotten into this microfluidics. I've been working in this area for maybe 7 years, almost 8 years now. We're mostly experimentalists, so this is mostly our interest, is building devices that actually have figures of merit that biologists and chemists and other engineers care about, and try to use these to try to aid biological discovery and perhaps things like massively parallel detection and reactions and things like this. So the first one I'll talk about is some instabilities. There are certain flow instabilities that occur when there's heterogeneous electrolytes. The second one is a type of shock wave that occurs when you have concentration with various mobilities. And there's certain extreme concentration ratios that are very difficult to model. And lastly is nanochannel electrophoresis, so doing electrophoresis in smaller and smaller channels. It's got to stop somewhere, right? So if we're at 40 nanometers deep, the microchannels we do, eventually you can't, you know, we can't go to picometer channel. So this is pretty extreme as well. So I'll spare you this. If you're at a microfluidics conference, you are partly convinced. If you stayed this late in the day, then you might also be convinced. And I appreciate you guys staying around. But the types of things that it promises for applications, such as point-of-care diagnostics, bioweapon detection, and pharmaceuticals, are things like reagent use, which are largely realized. There's a few commercialized microfluidic systems out there that actually have much less reagent use. Specificity and robustness, it offers some of this as well, and there's some evidence that this will be the case. Portability, there's some boxes from the national labs, which are like in New York subways, and they have microfluidics in them, looking for biological weapons, for example. And then things like potential for parallel analyses. This is still sort of things on the horizon. This is, I try to summarize microfluidics in one slide, the processes that occur in microfluidics in one slide. And you could say, well, there's a camp of people, including most of the assays that we work on, who work on separations. And these are ways to separate one species from another in an effort to detect them. And then you play a little detective game, what was in each peak and so on. Stacking, which you can say, in order to have separation, you need to have at least one non-zero drift velocity on one species. In order to have stacking, you need to have a divergence of that drift velocity on at least one species in order to concentrate. There's hybridization, so this is also commercial successes like Affymetrix with their gene chips, where there's a reaction between something in solution and the surface. And then most of the assays that the droplet microfluidics that we've heard about a lot today have to do with mix and look type applications. So most of the ones I'll talk about are separated look applications. And in fact, most of the papers and most of the interest in microfluidics is still in this type of area, although this droplet and mix and look reactions I think have great promise. And some of them, like for example the EWAD and other things, which are incredibly interesting, I still haven't really seen the killer app for these. But that's true of a few developing things. These are different methods that you might separate, so I just threw this together. These are different drift velocities that you can use to affect separations between different species in microfluidics. One of them might be simple diffusivity, and that's work like the University of Washington, where they separate analytes by diffusivity. One is mobility, which I'll describe. One is valence number, which I'll also describe. It turns out you can separate by both mobility and valence number independently, it turns out, of ions. Or affinity, so this I've already described. Polarizability, so this includes things like dielectrophoresis, paramagnetic beads to separate, you know, some protein reaction from a blood sample, which is used commercially. Or steric interactions, which also influences nanochannel. So just a little summary. I'll be talking about this mostly and this nanochannel work, and a little bit about steric interaction. So just to remind you very quickly, I'll be talking about electroosmotic flow. It has nothing to do with osmosis. It's a historical accident, the whole name. So nothing to do with it. Basically, if you have a channel, let's say glass, and it touches water, it spontaneously donates charges to the surfaces. There's spontaneous chemical reaction that occurs. That surface charge then gets shielded by counter ions from the bulk, and that shielding layer is anywhere between a few nanometers up to, say, 50, maybe 100 nanometers, depending on how low the ion density is. It's on the order of the bilength. If you put an electric field down this channel by, say, putting two electrodes up into a well, you get bulk flow of the motion, and that's called electroosmotic flow. There's some open questions, by the way, in this simple picture. For example, people still can't predict the level of zeta potential, that is the potential drop across the diffuse portion of this double layer from first principles. What you can do is take a few simple measurements and then use all the continuum theory that we have, where we split up these electric double layers into various layers and look at their capacitance and diffusion, electromigration characteristics, and predict variation. So with a few measurements, you can predict what would happen if you change concentration, what tends to happen as you change pH, ion density, valence number, things like this. What happens when there's electric double layer overlap? So this is, you know, for 40 years there's been papers on describing equations that solve the fluid equations and electrical equations, but I contend that these solutions are not unique. For example, if you have a certain channel and you know how that wall behaves as a function of chemistry, what happens to that same exact wall when you squish it or you place it next to another wall so that the spacing between these walls is on the order of the Debye line? Can you then predict the charge density of that same wall? Can you predict the zeta potential? People cannot, as far as I can tell. If you assume some boundary condition, then people can predict the flow inside it. But how do you predict the boundary condition from unoverlapped into the overlap regime? And lastly, people like Castellanos and Ramos at University of Seville, or Mark Bazant at Stanford, and Castellanos at UC Seville. People working on induced electric double layers. So induced electric double layers are looking at things like a capacitive coupling between an electrode and the electrolyte, and what happens when you put a large potential. Well, you can put large potentials, and people use potentials as high as a volt, but can you expect an ion to stay in a diffuse in solution when the potential drop is a volt? I don't think that's true. Okay, so the highest measurable zeta potential people have are something like less than 200 millivolts. Okay, that's like 8 of these thermal 25 millivolt voltages. If you get much higher than that, I think you're going to start condensing ions and building a jet. Okay, and this theory I don't think is well developed. So to trace, I place electrokinetics, this electrophoresis, electrosmosis, I place it under electrohydrodynamics. I thought this was fun, and I had an internet connection here, so I made up the slide. I think you might, but not during your talk, of course, during a break or something. I think you might credit Gilbert, if you're from the U.S., Gilbert, in 1580s with first studying electrohydrodynamics, because in his chapter, in his book, in his second book, which is called Of the Attraction Exerted by Amber, he describes the shapes of liquid droplets as you put this electrostatically charged stone next to it. So I think you can give him credit for that.
That's electrostatic.
Oh, well, it's the electric forces that make up, that change this droplet, are electrohydrodynamic. Well, they're electrohydrostatic. Thanks. But, you know, they have to move to get there, so that's... Sorry?
When you remove the stone,
it was exactly, or when you put the stone, it was dynamic. Exactly right. it had another shape before. It must have moved. Then you jump forward. Let's jump forward. How much is that? 229 years. Let's jump forward, and there's first experimental observations of what is now called electroosmotic flow in this paper in 1809 by Roos. So what does that mean in terms of microfluidics? These are a couple of experiments. On the left-hand side, we visualize with these cage dyes and micro-laser light sheets, and it's a long story. But basically, we visualize pressure-driven flow, or we visualize electrokinetic flow. You see that there's you don't see the dye that's left behind inside this no-slip condition inside this layer because it's so thin, it's not detectable. If this room were a 50-micron channel, the double layers that people typically look at are on the order of the roughness of the carpet, okay? So way below a wavelength. And then you can do experiments like this where you inject using electroosmosis and electrophoresis. You pull out a bit of a sample. This sample has two species, and the two species separate from each other because they have different drift velocity over time. They also disperse due to diffusion and certain Taylor dispersions, as I'm sure Sandeep talked about. You can see also for a wide range of these elution techniques like chromatography, electrochromatography, liquid and gas, electrophoresis, gel electrophoresis, capillary zone electrophoresis, they all have the same sort of paradigm, where you inject the sample. The longer you wait, the better your resolution gets, right? But the lower your signal noise ratio gets. So it's always a race between these two. Typically, the width of these things increases the square root of time, the dispersion process, and the signal, the resolution, increases as time, because that's a difference between drift velocity. So often you're faced with this increasing resolution, which the non-dimensional resolution increases the square root of time. And you'd like to move your detector downstream to get better and better resolution and discriminate between smaller and smaller mobilities. Eventually, you lose signal noise ratio. So what we'd like to do is, what can we take off-the-shelf chips like this and do something clever here upstream to both increase concentration and maybe even preserve concentration as you separate? Can we also do something to the channel in order to separate by something other than electrophoretic mobility? Okay? So that leads to the following three subjects that I'm going to talk about: this electrokinetic stabilities, the pre-concentration methods with this shock waves, and this nanochannel, which is basically making this channel very, very shallow. So electrokinetics offers certain advantages. There's some disadvantages. It offers certain advantages on microchips. One of them is you can have electric control of the switching and the flow rates with no moving parts. You can have very little dispersion. So if you have no pressure gradients and no internally generated electric body forces, you can achieve low dispersion. But most importantly, more important than any of this, you can integrate with separation techniques. And this is why I think that if your sole interest is to create devices and structures that try to have pumping that competes with electroosmotic pumping, I think that misses the boat. Okay? The interesting thing about electrokinetic pumping is not how efficient or the voltage, or is that you can easily integrate it with separation techniques like electrophoresis and many other elution techniques. Okay, so first I want to talk about this instabilities and why we became interested in this, because we wanted to make assays and chip flow fields that had heterogeneities in the electrolyte chemistry. For example, Dave Huber from our group has his poster on thermal gradient focusing. He has temperature gradients, pressure gradients, and potential gradients, and uses this to focus different analytes in different locations. We've done field amplified sample stacking where you use conductivity gradients. This is a movie from Dave Huber's work where he focuses these bands at different temperatures. Field amplified sample stacking, where you use conductivity gradients to increase concentration by these mismatched fluxes at the interface where you accumulate ions. We've also worked on two-dimensional assays where in one channel you have a pH gradient and the other you don't, and there's different mobilities in different places. All of these lead to interfaces between one electrolyte and another. And something as simple as a different ion density in one stream than another could generate an electric body force, could make this flow become unstable. So here are some examples of some of these instabilities. The first two columns here are under a DC electric field. You can see that there's these little waves that's set up in 100 micron by, it's 10 microns deep, about 10 to 1 aspect ratio. You see these waves develop here. You see these fluctuations as you try to flow from the west to the south.
This is, I'm sorry, the dye is something which is conducting? Is this what is
the... No. So the dye is rhodamine B, which is largely uncharged. The electrophoretic mobility of the dye is negligible. So as the interface is moving, you're seeing liquid moving this way.
Are you going to explain this now?
Sorry?
Are you going to explain this now?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. I'll explain as much as I know about it in the next 3 minutes.
You know, I was saying, because otherwise I was going to ask you a question.
Sure, okay. Oh, no. So what happens is one stream has one conductivity, one ion density. Another stream has a different ion density. Yeah. Okay? So the mechanism... That we propose for this. Basically, we've done a bunch of experiments. We had something like 10,000 different experiments. Well, that was one student's thesis. It's like eight repetitions per condition. So you know, thousands of conditions. We found there's certain clues that we got. For example, that these transverse velocities. By the way, everything here is low Reynolds number. These are, when you see it with particles, you see these three-dimensional trajectories. This Reynolds number here, even though it looks turbulent, is actually 10 to the minus 1. This is 10 to the minus 2 Reynolds number, so 0.01 Reynolds number here as well. What it turns out is that these are electrohydrodynamic stabilities, that these transverse velocity scales electric field squared. And what happens is that in classical electrohydrodynamics, like Melcher and Taylor looked at, they were interested in larger scale with very low conductivity systems, things like corn oil and centimeter scale with huge electric fields. And often in their models, they left out things like the importance of diffusion at these interfaces.
Well,
these are miscible liquids.
Sure. So is there surface tension?
No. So these are miscible liquids?
Because classical electrodynamics is not RC, so it's immiscible liquids.
It often is, but there are papers by Melcher and Taylor who looked at miscible liquids. Actually, mostly Melcher. Yeah. MIT guy.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Make sure I get the right MIT people. okay. Okay. So it turns out I'll tell you the answer. It turns out that you can write a set of equations where you include diffusion and you include electroosmosis in order to get the right convection and the right vortex structure shedding and so on. And these same equations can predict electrohydrodynamic events or these electrokinetic type instabilities, which are just the regime of electrohydrodynamic events. So here's a mechanism, right, which is what I think you're asking for. Imagine you have two streams. They're co-flowing streams. They're miscible. It just happens that there's a little more salt concentration here than here. So this might occur at an intersection. Initially, there's an electric field pointing downstream and everything's stable. But if there's some small perturbation, in this case, it's some global wave, and this linear treatment we'll treat as a global wave. The electric field lines, they used to be parallel. Now they sample this high conductivity region. And when they do, you can show that wherever there's electric field parallel to a conductivity gradient, there's a mismatch in how many positive charges are arriving versus leaving, and the same thing for negative charges. So you accumulate net charge in the bulk flow. This creates an electric body force, which then further distorts the interface and leads to instabilities or streamlines, as say it looked like this for small perturbations in this problem. Yeah, please.
On the side, it's not, I think I've seen that slide before, and it's not obvious to me that given the size of the charges, it is actually destabilizing.
Hmm? Let me see.
He said it's not obvious from the size of the charges that it's destabilizing.
That you drove through the electric field, it seems to be pulling the interface.
It's also a
straightening.
I mean, it's complicated.
Now the thing is, it's not a sinusoidal disturbance. That doesn't have to be a sinusoidal disturbance. But the real mechanism is the fact that there's dipole interactions between these, and as these come together, they push the stream next to each other, and that distorts that part of the interface. So it's not necessarily locally that this moves exactly down, but that it moves closer to this one. And as they do, if you conserve mass, then this has to distort the interface in between.
So this is a finite connectivity effect.
Sorry?
These are finite connectivity effects.
Yes, that's right. These are leaky dielectrics, and they're leaky as hell.
Yeah.
This is millimolar concentrations all the way up to molar concentrations this occurs.
So the principle of the instability exists for any finite
connectivity. For any finite conductivity, in fact, yeah. So this is what, when people in the 60s were doing electrohydrodynamics on corn oil, they were initially interested in this because they thought they would be dielectrics.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, there's enough small residual charge that accumulates at the interfaces and gives you the electrohydrodynamic instabilities. I'm not going to talk about this. I'll refer to some papers here. You can read the papers. But for small-scale electrokinetic or electrohydrodynamic instabilities where there's a coupling between them, the motions, the transverse motions, and electroosmosis, it turns out that you can write equations that describe this. You can also identify controlling parameters, and this is one such problem that we've formulated for the case where you have a Healy-Shaw sort of geometry, where there's a small depth compared to the width of these things. And it's an electric, a modified type electric Rayleigh number, which is basically a ratio of the electric body forces to the viscous forces, right? And diffusion is in there because diffusion smears out these gradients, which lowers the charge density, lowering the electric body force, right? And the friend in town, in terms of the mechanics, if you want stability, is viscosity. That's why it's in the denominator. It turns out that the difference between positive and negative charges scales this way with electric field and conductivity ratio and the length scale of these diffusion. And that becomes very small, so you can use this net neutrality approximation that people use in electrolytes. Even though there's net charge, you use net neutrality. So net neutrality doesn't mean no net charge. Net neutrality means that the number of positives is about equal to the number of negatives only when you're solving the conservation of species equations. Another thing I want to say about this is you can write these equations for example, the evolution of conductivity field, and conductivity is a summation across many ion densities and their mobilities. If you have more than two species, more than just positive and negative species, like say Melcher did and Taylor did, then immediately the problem becomes more complicated and there's new terms in the equations associated with electromigration. And it turns out, one of our papers that we've written on this, that this can change the problem drastically. That is, you can do an electrokinetic instability experiment and you would measure a certain threshold electric field. If you then add a third species and very low concentration, something like 1,000 times less concentration than the first two species, it can change the critical electric field by two orders of magnitude. So multiple species events are very important. It's that little special sauce, and you can change the electrokinetic the threshold electric field. Yeah, sure.
So you in the analysis that went above the sentence that you just said, you didn't include ohms. So what you're calling electromigration, that's just ohms law, right?
That's
just that the current is proportional. I mean, that's the current.
No, actually.
That the current is proportional to the field times.
No, no. So I would write ohms law like this, right? Ohm's law actually comes from a conservation of the charge density equation.
No, no, but wait, sorry. It's not sigma E, it's actually number density of ion. It's Ohm's law is J is equal to, it's current.
Yeah, well,
the field, right? That's not sigma. That's not the sigma you wrote there. That's
Ohm's law is not a law. It's a hack. Okay.
No, it's
first
not
one.
A hack.
No, no, it's a hack. Let me tell you why. Ohm's law says this is the flux of ions that you get when you have an electric potential due to their electromigration. But ions move for two other reasons. This is why it's happening. Ions move for two other reasons. They move because of advection, and they move because of diffusion. And both of these can become on the order of electromigration.
But the Ohm's law effect is the effect when the mobility is determined by the field. That is, the motion is the force on the ion is from the field, right? And for that, you know, Ohm's law, that is I is equal to whatever the conductivity times.
Okay. Ohm's law is correct as long as that law that it's trying to describe
What you're saying is that in the problem that you've studied,
right?
I guess the variance of this is that the Ohm's law, the currents that come from Ohm's law are smaller than the diffusive, are very small. But is the redistribution
The redistribution of charge is mostly from this, it turns out to be about zero.
Right, that's what I'm surprised. It mostly comes from diffusion. That's what you're arguing.
Yeah, actually.
Maybe it's just words. I don't want to interrupt that. Sorry.
No, no, it's a good. We can talk about that. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
No.
Okay. Basically, what you can do is if you have two species, positive and negative, you can write the positive species, concentration of the negative, and you subtract them.
But that's how you derive Ohm's law.
True, which is an approximation. For example, Ohm's law doesn't hold in the double layer. In the double layer, Ohm's law tells you that you would have electromigration, all the ions would end up at the wall. But there's an equal and opposite flux due to diffusion, and only the balance of these.
I wouldn't have said it that way.
Okay.
It's just that there are other effects.
Yeah, okay, that's right. It's just like, I don't know, I put a hat on and I see a television show, I shouldn't say, oh, there's the hat law. No, because whether or not the television show occurs actually depends on many things. and it just happens that my neighbor, who's a director, saw me put the hat on. You see what I'm saying? In certain cases, Ohm's law speaks for very little of the charge transfer, and most of it might be due to diffusion.
Anyway, we
okay. That's a little extreme. My hat is a pretty extreme example. These are some models that we've written for this, nonlinear models, where we just take the equations, we depth average them, we turn up electric fields, we include the non-uniform electroosmosis, although you don't have to, and this still becomes unstable. This first column is marginally stable, so you see this little preferred wavelength that's chosen, and it begins to grow. This is way into the nonlinear regime, where you see the stretching and folding of these material lines. We compare this with experiment. The magnitude of the electric field at which you get these instabilities is well predicted by these type of models, and the rate of growth. Okay, so up to now I was hoping that to describe that this is the type of things that we think we have a pretty good handle on. Okay, that is, we can take these modified ohmic law formulations, ohmic conservation of conductivity. If you take those, if you have two different types of charges, they work very well. If you add new ions, you have these new terms in the conservation of the ions, of the summation of the ions. And if you take those into account, you can also predict some variations that we see in the experiments. But now I'm going to tell you some things that we can't yet predict for a couple reasons. Here's what happens when you have an intersection. And you apply an electric field from the north to the east, from the south to the east, and from the west to the east. So there's three different flows all meeting together. The conductivity of the center stream is larger than the sheath conductivity, than the rest of the conductivity. As you turn up the electric field, you reach some modified electric Rayleigh number distribution. It becomes marginally stable, so you start to see these nearly sinusoidal disturbances. Here on the right-hand side, I plot a power spectrum. You could do it different ways, but if you walk down this fluctuations, you pick the maximum fluctuation, the x location at which you get maximum fluctuation, and we plot the intensity versus time. That's a one-dimensional signal. We take the power spectrum of that one-dimensional signal, and that's what's plotted here. Okay, so you see a strong DC component, and then you see this strong fundamental frequency, which is this little sinusoidal frequency. You see also the birth of the first harmonic of this, which is just right here, an integer multiple of the first one. As it starts to grow. As you increase the electric field, you see the growth of the first harmonic, you see the birth or the first evidence of the second harmonic in addition to the fundamental electric field. The flow here is deterministic, and the models show this. The models capture this transition between deterministic shedding of structures and their transition to multiple peaks. So this is analogous to turbulence. They also capture, to some degree, a little of the rest, but not much. if you increase the electric field further, I'm going to stop this one because it's not that interesting.
Sorry, that
would
be sure. The first harmonic, not first picture.
Sorry, say again?
Your little peak isn't at the first harmonic.
Okay. This thing right here? So you're saying this interval here is not the same as here. So in order to really focus in on the DC, it doesn't really start at zero. See how the data starts a little after zero. So I think that's what you're saying. You see what I mean? It's a little shifted to the right, just to make a little more clarity. Because people really like to look at the DCP.
There are really two different potential instability modes in this, right? One is this, and the other is this.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And you analyze both.
Yeah, so
but you've only got the word you're using, I mean, that was a question.
So in the linear theory, what we've done is done temporal stability analysis with, like, you know, plane waves and
no, but I mean, if you consider the two interfaces can either be exactly out of phase.
Oh yeah.
Or
so
they can be in phase.
In the linear stability analysis, for this geometry, all we've done is some nonlinear models, where we have some initial condition and we just let them go.
Did you consider each of the two interfaces?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 The model considers the initial condition. Is that what you're asking?
I think so.
Okay. So this is right at the border where we don't have, so all this other stuff, we have like 8 papers and 30,000 experiments that we've done over the last 3 years, and we can predict many trends. Right here at the slide, this is where our understanding really stops. Okay. So as you increase the electric field further, you get new frequencies. It looks like period doubling now, right? So now there's new frequencies that are born that occur in between the first frequencies, and I'll show you a diagram that shows that even better. At higher electric fields, you get this distributed spectrum, like a spread spectrum. Maybe there's some transition and chaos, and you get this distributed spectrum. This is a plot that captures much of that data. So all of these type of experiments, we try to summarize them in one big... So this was Jonathan Poser took this data, and it took him about a year and a half. Maybe two. there's a lot of data here. So here we plot a frequency on the x-axis, temporal frequency of the concentration oscillation. We plot this non-dimensionalized electric field on the y-axis. You can think of it just as electric field as you increase electric field. And the color, the intensity here, is the power spectrum, right? Is the intensity of each frequency of the power spectrum. What you can see is at low fields, initially it's DC electric field, you raise the electric field further, and you see you excite this first harmonic frequency here. You increase it further, and you see what looks like a harmonic. It looks like a harmonic. It's a nonlinear system, so we don't expect exactly things to be at integer multiples necessarily. You increase it further and you see the third one. At some electric field, you see the birth of these intermeeting, they look like fingers that are in between the original frequencies. So that's what we call evidence of period doubling. Right? So now there's new frequencies in addition to these original frequencies. You increase the electric field further, you've probably seen what I'm getting to already, it gets continuous. You increase the governing parameter further, and you go back to order. From complete chaos and disorder, you go back to an ordered state. Okay? Sorry.
Shouldn't there be another
parameter? I'm sure it's possible.
It happened.
But none of our models can capture it, and no one's models can capture it.
Well, it's usually hard to capture.
Yeah. Okay, great. Sorry? Sorry, go ahead.
Shouldn't there be another parameter that's the conductivity contrast?
Yeah, so for this whole plot, this is one conductivity. This is why it took him 2 years, because he did like 20 of them.
But what is the other dimension?
You're a very smart guy. Sorry, go ahead.
What is the other dimensionless parameter that you use? Obviously, conductivity contrast.
The three main dimensionless parameters, actually four main, four main dimensional parameters are this electric Rayleigh number, okay, the ratio of electrophoretic mobilities to electroosmotic mobilities. They determine transitions between, say, convective instabilities and absolute instabilities. Okay, we can talk about that. That's the second parameter. The third non-dimensional parameter of interest is the ratio of this width to this stream. It turns out if this stream gets very thin, that stabilizes the flow because it kills your concentration gradients. If it gets very thick, it also stabilizes the flow because, again, it kills your concentration gradients. So there's an optimal thickness in this.
Two fluids. The blue is one fluid and the red is...
It's the same fluid. Only one stream is seeded with a passive dye. That's not electrically charged.
But what is causing the ionic difference?
So it's the same fluid except for the fact that, well, it's the same solvent and you've added more salt.
Okay, so the salt and the salty and less salty are like layered? Is that how it's coming in?
So there's high salt concentration from here, low salt concentration from here.
Oh, I see.
Okay. But they're missing. These are miscible liquids, right? So there's a diffusion gradient of concentration right here.
The two streams mixing at the corner, and one has the salt in it, or has more salt.
It's actually two corners, so this is an intersection. Sorry, if you're in electrokinetics, you see this thing in every paper. So after a while, I wish I had a stamp. I could just go and show you a flow field. Yeah. Well, let me show you our flow field. So anyway, so my point here, it's very difficult for us to capture this.
So if you keep going,
yeah.
You get disorder
again. Yeah, exactly right.
And does it come back again? It looks like it might.
Well, see, up here, we start heating up the liquid.
What's the maximum field?
Yeah, and so now there's new effects. Sorry.
What's the maximum field that you watch?
The maximum field, local field, or the nominal field? That is, the voltage divided by length?
Voltage divided by length.
The voltage divided by lengths are something like, maximum is 2,000 volts per centimeter. 2 kilovolts per centimeter, but local voltages might be as high as 10,000 volts per centimeter. Actually, 8,000 volts per centimeter. Pretty high, and that's why we're heating the liquid up here. but otherwise, we're pretty sure that we're not heating up the liquid, and we can track that from other things. So anyway, our models don't yet capture any of these what I think are pretty interesting rich physics. This is what happens if you plot a concentration at one time versus concentration another time as a function of this parameter that's increasing. If the thing is stable, you just get this little dot in the middle. It fluctuates because of diffusion. If you go into unstable regimes, you get these lobes associated with these harmonic oscillations that are not sinusoidal, so they have some structure to them. And as you increase electric field, then you get to this distributed spectrum. Again, you get this white noise-looking correlation plots. We can't predict any of this. So.
But this is local concentration?
Yeah, this is local concentration, okay. And plotted with itself at a time shifted. So it's like a phase plot. Phase plot for that pixel location. I took a music class when I was a freshman. And they told me that music is about sort of setting a tone, is what the guy told me. Anyway, setting tone and then having a little tension and then relieving the tension, okay, right toward the end. So what I'm doing with this talk is I'm hoping to set a little tone, give you a little relief, and then hit you with tension. And then go to the next topic. So that was that tension. Okay. Maybe not so nice. Isotachophoresis. Kind of a history of this. The first person who started theoretically looking at electrokinetics is probably this Kohlrausch, and he derived this so-called Kohlrausch function associated with the electrophoretic migration of different ions. Since then, there's been people that have done things that look like ITP all the way from the 30s to people who are now doing it on chip, and that goes forward to the late 90s. Here's more recent history, if you're interested. But these are different methods of increasing concentration, ITP, field amplified sample stacking, and so on.
Are you going to tell us what this word means?
Are these things right here?
No, I talk
up. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Sure. Sorry. Actually, no. I'll tell you. I'll tell you in a second. Yeah. I'll tell you in a second. I don't want to spoil that one. It's a really good one.
So this is tension one.
That's right. This is tension. I'll give you a little relief, and then I'm going to hit you with the tension again. It's like music from some, you know, with a hammer and a dissonant guitar. Okay. This is a motivation for this concentration increase. But basically, what we do is here is plot the concentration of sample detected using separation and then detection, using capillary electrophoresis, both in capillaries, freestanding capillaries, and on chip, versus the molar sensitivity, which is a word the chemists use, but basically it's the number of molecules that were detected, right? So a single molecule would be down here somewhere, 10 to the minus 23rd. And what you could see is that the different detection modes group nicely into fluorescence, which is the most sensitive, UV absorbance, which is the least sensitive, and yet it's one of the most common. Okay, the reason is it's very easy to interpret, very easy to cheap to set up, and you don't have to tag your analytes with any fluorescence, right? You can look at them in their wild state. In the middle is this developing field of electrochemical detection, where there's different modes of this, but basically you have two or three, sometimes four electrodes, and you look at the impedance between these electrodes in order to try to detect the sample as it goes by these electrodes. There's also radiochemical detection, and people who integrate mass spec with CE and use mass spec as a way of detection. So it's a whole other giant machine after this electrophoresis. And the reason I put this up is it then becomes, the challenge then is one of two. First, you either try to increase concentration, if this is initial concentration, you take your concentration, you try to increase it, and then do your separation and detect it, right? And the more you can increase, the lower the initial concentration you can use. So you try to move down here with your best equipment, right? And we can do that. But what I think is more interesting is being able to take your sample of an intermediate concentration, increase the concentration to a very high level, to put you up into this regime in order to use a cheap detector, in order to try to make microfluidic systems that are more proliferated, where there's less need for these giant microscopes and lasers and so on, right? So I think that's the more interesting problem. Can you start with picomolar and yet detect it with a bad electrochemical detection? In order to do that, you need to increase the concentration by six orders of magnitude. If you look back here of the different methods that people have used to increase concentration both on a chip and in capillaries, the best that people have done on a chip is something like a factor of 500. The best they've done in a capillary is a factor of 5,000. So they're off by something like three orders of magnitude. So what we use is this method called isotachophoresis. So iso is single, tacho is a velocity, and phoresis is motion. Okay. What you do is you create an interface between a leading electrolyte and a trailing electrolyte. Okay. I'm showing here all the negative ions, all the anions, and I'm not going to show you the counterions because it's the same counterion throughout. In our experiments, it's sodium. Okay. And to a high degree, the net neutrality approximation holds, so wherever there's a negative, there's also a positive. Right? Okay. You slam on an electric field at this interface. You can create this interface at one of these intersections in the microchannel, right? You slam on an electric field. What happens then, these small ions, these leading ions, have very high mobility, and the green ions, the trailing ions, have very low mobility. Your sample is dispersed uniformly in the trailing electrolyte, and it has an intermediate mobility, so you have to meet this condition, right? Okay, you slam on the electric field. Anywhere there where there's a sample and a background electrolyte, the sample will move faster, and so it'll overspeed these. If that sample diffuses into the fast electrolyte region, the fast ions will leave it behind, okay? There's a deterministic drift velocity which comes into play. Sorry? Oh yeah, this is 1897 technology right here. Absolutely right. Yeah. Except the best Kohlrausch ever did was like a factor of 10. So he wouldn't even make it to that little plot.
Yeah. The separation technique is...
This is Kohlrausch. This is 1897 technology. Absolutely right. You slam on an electric field. Sample ions will overspeed. They'll tend to stack at a certain region here, right? You might ask, well... And you probably know, why wouldn't these negative ions just outspeed and leave these blue ions behind? Why don't you think that happens? Sorry?
Of charge.
Well, no, you can. Exactly right. If these ions would tend to trot over speed, they would leave positive ions behind, which creates a huge internal dipole and brings them back. Exactly right. So in order to meet the electron neutrality conditions.
What? I mean, if the negative ions go ahead, they take their counter ions with them, so, and then the rest is just neutral fluid.
Yeah, but how? Then what counter ions would supply this region?
Well, the other ones. When they're
Which
neutral,
other ones?
When there are counter ions for each and every one of them, so this thing is neutral.
No, but the counter ions are moving in an opposite direction. Right, so you're saying counter ions,
okay,
this negative one's going to take it. No way.
The cathode is the other end.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, to the left. Yeah. That's right. They're going opposite direction. Absolutely right. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So you form this thing and so on. Some of the challenges here. So if you write the Korosh function for this, basically Korosh wrote the conservation equations, what this gentleman is talking about. He wrote the conservation equations. He said, in some regime, I'm going to ignore diffusion. 1897, and we're going to have a balance between advection due to electromigration, right? And we're going to sum all of these species, and then we're going to have a constraint, and the constraint is everywhere has to be remain net neutral. And what that does is it says, well, at this location, you have to preserve this thing called the Korosh function, which is the summation of the concentration of ions divided by their mobility. That function has to be remain constant at each place. Okay, if you use that simple Korosh theory, it says that the final concentration of the analyte that you can achieve scales as the leading electrolyte concentration, right? Okay. The other thing that's not sort of shown here is that there's also an important dispersion analysis and doesn't come into Korosh directly. He didn't consider it. The fact that you can't just keep concentrating this into, say, a nanometer shock wave. You have to allow for diffusion, and diffusion has enough flux. Not predicted by Ohm's law. No, that's not a thing. I'm sorry. So the diffusion has both current flux and concentration flux, which would prevent you from doing that. Okay. Further, there's electrosmotic flow here and here, and the electric field here is much lower than it is here because the ion density here is very high. You use that because you try to get high sample concentration. So there's non-uniform electrosmotic flow, which causes internal pressure gradients, which causes non-uniform pressure to flow in each one of these locations, right? So there's a dispersion problem associated with this. And that dispersion problem scales in such a way that as you increase electric field, it gets worse compared to the electromigration fluxes. Okay, yet you can do this on a chip. So the types of things that we do are we reduce electrosmotic mobility. So this is one of these little shock waves. As it develops and as it propagates downstream. This region here has a leading electrolyte, very high concentration of fast ions. This is the sample ion. This is an intermediate concentration of sample ions associated with the fact that you have to meet the local Korosh function here. And downstream is the trailing electrolyte, which preserves its original Korosh function and concentrations. Okay. This is the type of signal that you would see. Skip that. Okay. I just want to make a couple comments about this. This isotachophoretic concentration shock waves are amazingly stable. Okay. If the original leading electrolyte zone has a finite sample size, if you have a finite injection of samples, then you'll stack, and then you'll stop stacking, and there'll be some finite amount of ions that are there. And you reach some quasi-steady state where the concentration is steady and the width is steady, if you have an initial finite length. And this thing will propagate for a long time. We've observed it 1,000 diameters downstream, and there's no dispersion. So it's like a soliton, this thing, right? It's a wave that does not disperse over thousands of diameters as it goes downstream. You can also, here you're also transporting ions using electrophoresis with no dispersion, right? You can transport a centimeter across the chip, and actually you might have more concentration when you get there versus less concentration. You can also do things to break the isotachophoretic mode and initiate electrophoretic separation, which we can talk about, but I'm not going to talk about too much. This thing is also very stable to geometrical disturbances. Here, so this is the work of Tarun Khurana, who's sitting in the back here. He's created these isotachophoretic shock waves and then goes into a big expanded channel that's 5 millimeters tall and puts this little shock wave over these little glass beads. And even though they get geometrically distorted as it goes by, this thing writes itself. And he's done experiments where he does this isotachophoretic shock wave. He puts a huge pressure to flow. And then this thing recovers and it goes back to its original state. So it's very stable. The only thing it's not very stable to is to raising the electric field further and further. Then you start getting electrokinetic instabilities, just like I talked about before.
Can you tell us what's the scale of the leaf?
Oh, so this is 50 microns.
No. Physically, what are the physical parameters that set the scale of the pulse?
Oh, they set the scale. Oh, that's a great question. So at low electric fields and for low conductivities, the width of the pulse is determined solely by these concentration ratios, by this Kohlrausch theory with no diffusion. But as you start asking the pulse to be thinner and thinner, then diffusion comes into play. So there's a balance between electromigration and diffusion. And actually, that's Tarun's thesis. Yeah.
But what do you interrupt that front?
Right.
And I mean, shut the current off.
Right.
And then let it spread.
Right.
And then put the field back on.
Right.
You'll see intermittent effects behind that channel, behind the sharpening boundary and free electric forces.
Okay. You'll see intermittent effects. What do you mean by intermittent?
Well, I mean you see the shedding of a peak behind the main peak as the boundary sharpens up.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, yeah. You can get peak splitting of one species. Oh, yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. In other nonlinear regimes where you have field amplified Sapir stackings, you can also get same species, two peaks, depending on the history of these things.
I showed that in 1970.
Oh, cool. Sorry? Oh, great point. Yeah, yeah, great point. So if all of those multiple ionic species, if their mobilities are all bounded by these two mobilities, then they'll all travel inside here, and they won't separate from each other.
They all come into the same.
Into the same zone. They segregate within that zone, but they're one right on top of the other. See what I mean? And that's why it's called isotacho. All the analytes are moving at the same velocity, and they're in the same region. Exactly right.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
So, what's up for maximum concentration? What's up for color of this? What's up dot scale concentration scale?
For the experiments that I'm showing you, this concentration increases are between like 100 and 1,000.
Let me rephrase.
Oh, sorry.
The mechanism you've described, at least if I understand what you said, is purely linear. That is, you said there's a difference in electrophoretic mobilities, and so that causes a band. On the other hand, concentration difference disperse.
Right,
and that those two are fighting with each other. But in order to get what you just showed, it would seem that there has to be a nonlinearity. I just don't, because otherwise...
Well, why do you say it's linear? I don't see that.
It just seems like maybe I'm misunderstanding. I mean, somehow...
In order for there to be this preservation with no dispersion?
Yeah, I would have thought there was nonlinearity. I mean, you were the one who said soliton.
There's a spatial divergence in fluxes.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is there must be some. So you told me the number when I asked what the concentration was. You told me the number. There must be some balance argument.
There's some mobility parameters times electric field, and both of these are varying. So there's a product. There's an nonlinearity.
What do you mean they vary with?
With space.
So do they vary with field or with concentration? They don't.
So electric field is a function of local concentration, of the local summations of all the concentrations.
So that's the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So local field is a function of all of the local ions and all of their mobilities. So there's a function of both concentrations and mobilities. Yeah.
But do you know, do you have a plot of maximum concentration as a function of, I guess, field?
So there's some things we could do, and I'll show you in a second. So we have models that include depth average formulations in order to predict dispersions. So this is isotachophoretic shock or development of three different analytes, including diffusion and including the Taylor dispersion associated with local pressure driven flows and so on. And if you zoom in, you get what you would expect. You get the three species, just like you were asking about. They're segregated with respect to each other, and they're sandwiched between this leading and trailing electrolyte. Yeah. So this picture so far, I'm hoping that you say, oh yeah, this looks like people have a handle on this, and they've been doing it for 9,000 years. I don't know, long time. What we can't reproduce at all is our best results. And our best results is, well, how can you get higher and higher concentration? And empirically, how do you do this optimization? So there's a work both of Tarun Kurana's here and Byosuk Jung in our group. One of them is you have to play with surface chemistry, so you have to suppress electrosmotic flow in order to minimize this effect of dispersion, this non-uniform electrosmotic flows. You also have very high gradients. So this is one thing I want to talk about. The two key concentration parameters are the leading electrolyte concentration, right, and the initial concentration of the sample. You divide those, and that's the stacking ratio, right? It's a first order if you don't take into account diffusion, okay? So it's the first order. Well, that number is 10 to the 15, okay? So, you know, double precision in a computer is like 10 to the 16. So, and it turns out, you have to, and the other thing that's interesting is the best that we've been able to do is millionfold stacking, right? We do millionfold stacking with 10 to the 15th concentration ratio. So we're far from the ideal, and it's due to this diffusion thing, which is what Tarun's going to explain completely in his thesis.
But do you have a plot of what you actually achieve as a function of that concentration ratio? Is it square root?
Oh no! So basically, to the best of our knowledge, the fact that you don't get this large concentration ratio is due solely to the fluxes of diffusions.
Right, but there should
to
be
the
a law.
Currents
there,
and the fluxes.
But there should be a law, right? If you plot the stacking that you achieve is a function of that concentration.
Yeah, we don't have enough experiments yet for that. Yeah, and one reason is because the real experiments that you want are where you have constant current.
Right.
And so that it's pretty difficult to build this high voltage stuff and control constant current with an unsteady impedance. Sorry?
And you can also plot it as a current.
Instantaneous current.
Yeah.
But it's unsteady.
What, the current is unsteady?
The whole thing is unsteady.
No, it's moving. It's a stable. I think you said it was a solid
current. No, so for the highest concentration ratios, instead of having a finite injection plot, we keep injecting ions until we see what happens. Yeah, we keep injecting ions. So, in fact, this whole thing is unsteady.
So the soliton, how high was the injection ratio for the soliton?
Anywhere between 100 and 100,000.
But in that regime, you could make this plot.
You could what?
You could make this plot in that regime.
You could, but we don't have enough. We have like, 10 different data. Actually, we have a lot of data at constant voltage. And at constant voltage, it's very difficult to reduce all the data because of this unsteady impedance. We have models, for example, where we can predict the width of the thing with a control volume analysis. We can predict the diffusion width. This is what Tarun does. The width of the diffusion between the trailing electrolyte and the leading electrolyte as a function of electric field, as a function of the history of the thing, right? What we can't do is have, say, a numerical model that can capture this 10 to the 15th concentration ratio and the fact that there are centimeter lengths that are important because they determine the total flux of these things. Mm-hmm. And there's also 1 micron lengths that are important, mm-hmm. which are the local diffusion gradients on either side of the shock. So there's some interesting, I think there might be some like perturbation solutions, but you have to do expansions in both concentration space and in space, mm-hmm. right? Which maybe is interesting to you. So this is why I put this out. So this is a plot of the level of stacking that we've achieved compared to the field here. So something like 3 orders of magnitude better than the second best stacking, and this, and near single molecule resolution. But this is really the interesting thing. I think the interesting thing is you can start here, which is of interest in biology, and then detect it with a cheap detector. That's where the real thing is. So what can we do in case you're interested? So we can detect like 100 attomolar concentrations. So that's equivalent to taking a single grain of salt, dissolving it in 1,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools, taking out a microliter from one pool, and detecting that with a 20-to-1 or 15-to-1 signal noise ratio. Okay. So just to give some perspective to what being down here means on a double log plot. Right? This is somebody's life. They're a PhD thesis. Hey, thanks a lot for this. Without you, we wouldn't have this point right here. Anyway, okay. Okay. I just put this up here. My colleagues, we have a collaboration with Habib Najam and Bert Debouchere at Sandia National Labs. They, for obvious reasons being at Sandia, they have a lot of experience with flame fronts and detonation waves and things where there's this spatial stiffness and concentration and reactions. They've written a model that's much more comprehensive than our model. Their model actually not only includes multiple species and dispersion, but they actually resolve the detailed buffer kinetics. And it turns out this is important if you want to preserve pH and know what you're separating. And so they've been able to do this. And yet, they're not able to resolve this Mueling-fold stacking. They have, I think, the best model out there, but it's still not good enough. Okay, so with the last thing, I just want to talk about a little about, so again, I'm ending at a point where we don't know how to attack this problem with these huge concentration ratios. And you can't do something simple, for example, by taking the logarithm of all these concentrations and writing your concentration equations in terms of logarithms, because when you consider these buffer kinetics, which are important, there's multiplications of these concentrations in those reactions. So this logarithm thing doesn't, this trick doesn't work. Okay. To talk about an extreme length scale, so I'm going to talk a little about nanochannel electrophoresis. Yeah, sorry. Oh, 2 minutes? Okay. All right. I'm just going to talk about this quickly. 2 minutes. So imagine that you have this microchannel with two different anions with two different mobilities. One has a fast mobility. I'm sorry, they have the exact same mobility. Sorry, these two ions have the exact same mobility, but one of them has a higher valence number. It turns out that in a nanochannel, you can separate them even though they have the same mobility, right? The reason for that is that the ion with the higher valence hangs around near the wall. There's this transverse equilibrium between diffusion and electromigration, and the length scale of that double layer depends on the valence number, not the mobility. And so this, you can actually separate this in a nanochannel. And we have a theory that predicts this. We have experiments. And so this is the part without tension, hopefully, where if you do this area average, actually closed form analytical solutions of the electromigration in situations like this, you can predict the motion of these things. But recently we started putting DNA in these channels, even oligonucleotides that are 100 base pairs and lower. If you put them in a microchannel, they don't separate. If you put them in a nanochannel, they do separate. Okay, you get multiple peaks. And we have lots of data we can talk about. But basically, we can only explain, with simple analytical models, we can only explain the regime as the number of base pairs goes to zeros, which act like a small ion. And so what we think is needed is some sort of molecular dynamics model that includes many effects. And for example, each DNA, different lengths have different valences, so they have a different equilibrium length scale associated with transverse electromigration and diffusion. Also, their rods, for this short length, they're stiff rods. And so there's this migration associated with diffusion and rotation due to the velocity. That drives them to the edges, right? Yet the first effect drives them toward the center. So where they went out, maybe there's some equilibrium location. Sorry? No, proteins are very hard. They'll absorb to the surface. Yeah. And then they'll change UOF. Proteins is very difficult. And also, the fields inside these electric double layers are something like 10 to the fifth volts per centimeter. So you have to have a model for polarization of DNA associated with this. And those models are not well developed as far as I can understand. So this is another thing we don't understand. Yet we know it's useful because we can separate. So last slide. So near future work, we're going to try doing some three-dimensional electrokinetic stability with multiple species. I think that's what's needed in order to capture these transitions to chaos and so on. ITP modeling, including reaction kinetics, so this is in collaboration with the folks at Sandia, but also some analytical models. And I think there might be some analytical models possible for electromigration of DNA in nanochannels, but you'd have to take into account these asymmetric, or this non-isotropic diffusion constants. But there might be something there. And we, in the next month or so, we hope to do ITP in nanochannels, and we think there might be some advantages to doing that. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.